calendar, which is CFO versus Fair Jones.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Pamela Ureta and I represent the appellants in this matter. I'll have 4 minutes for rebuttal.
You've got to talk there, just keep track of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. The issue before the court this afternoon is whether an individual may escape liability under Title I and II of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act and under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act by drafting and utilizing an unlawful and invalid subpoena in order to gain access to the content of private email communications stored on a remote server. The answer to that question, Your Honor, is no. An individual cannot escape liability under those two federal statutes.
What in those statutes gives a private right of action?
Under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, Your Honor, there is a subsection which I don't have in mind right now, but which creates a private civil cause of action for conduct that is otherwise criminalized under the statute. And that conduct is intentionally accessing without authorization a facility upon which or through which an electronic communication service is provided.
And here the access was, explain to me exactly how that access happened.
In this case, the underlying action is a district court action that's venued in the Southern District.
I know what the underlying action is. What exactly happened? How was the... The ISP had these messages on its server, right?
Right. These individuals...
Did the defendants get access to the server?
Defendants drafted and utilized what was held to be an invalid and unlawful subpoena to get access to the server.
So how did they? Did they actually connect it to the server? Were electronically?
Yes. NetGate, in response to the unlawful subpoena, provided a URL, which provided a sample of 339 some-odd private emails.
They made copies of all those emails.
That's right.
Put them on a different server.
Put them on a URL on its server and allowed access to that URL.
Right. So I understand. They connected to that URL. The URL linked to storage on a different server.
On the same server. On NetGate's same server, is my understanding of the fact.
I thought it was a web server, not a mail server. The emails were stored on the mail server, and they copied them over. And it's like, so they made copies of documents saying, now you're going to be able, going to put it in the file cabinet, and you're going to look at the copies over there. Isn't that what happened? They never actually had access to the mail server.
They had access to NetGate server, and what NetGate did was copy a portion of the emails that were contained on its mail server and placed it on the other portion of its server, to which then it gave the appellees in this action access through.
So they didn't actually look at the emails. The copies were made, and they were put on a different server. My question is, how is the server that they actually access, the one where they look at the emails, how is that become a server that's involved in electronic communications?
It's a facility under the statute through which electronic communications.
But they didn't. They didn't actually do that. They didn't actually look at the mail on the mail server. The mail was copied, put somewhere else, and they gave them access to copies of the emails.
And I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, but the statute doesn't draw a distinction between which of the two servers is accessed. The statute.
It says it has to be a facility that's used for.
Through which an electronic service is provided.
Right, so it has to be something in mail service. There has to be a facility that's used for providing electronic mail service. If what they did is they take copies of all those emails and put them somewhere else, then they're no longer on the server that's used for electronic communications.
There's nothing in the statute, Your Honor, nor in any of the case law that limits the definition of an electronic, a facility that provides an electronic service to a mail server.
Let's say I have a server at home, okay? And let's say they make copies of all the emails and they call me up and they say, hey, you know, we need someplace to store a bunch of documents. Do you mind if we put it on your server? You know, I have nothing to do with electronics. It's my own personal server. Would you still say that if they, and then they made a link to my server where the things are, where the emails are copied, and they said, okay, you can look at all those emails on Kaczynski server.
Mm-hmm.
Would you still maintain that that was a facility that's used for communications?
Yes. Your server is a facility within the meaning of the statute.
Well,
to the extent.
How possibly can that be?
Because if you look at the language of the statute, what it says is that liability attaches when an individual, such as appellees in this case, intentionally access without authorization through which an electronic communication is provided. Your server in that context, in the hypothetical that you give, is a facility through which an electronic communication
just
is provided.
Just because the emails, the copies of the emails are stored there, even though they're not going anywhere, they are not coming from anywhere, even though that is not used in any sense for electronic communications.
Yes, Your Honor, and in your hypothetical, to the extent that NetGate purport or would purport to authorize access to your server, that authorization would be invalid because it doesn't have the ability to authorize access to your
private server. Presumably, they got my agreement.
Presumably, the people accessing got your agreement, but I understood your hypothetical to be that NetGate authorized
NetGate said, look, we're going to put it on somebody's server that's completely unconnected with us. It's another server being used for totally other reasons. We're going to make copies of these emails, and we're going to store them there. So they're like making photocopies of documents and saying, okay, we're going to put the photocopies in a file cabinet over there in the corridor. If you want to look at them, you can go to look at them. And I guess what I'm wondering is if the defendants only looked at the emails when they were stored on this other server, which is not a mail server, does it still fall within the language of the statute? Whether it's my personal server or it's their server or it's server or space they rented from somewhere else. I'm just wondering whether how that becomes access to a server, a facility that's used for electronic communications.
Because to the extent that the electronic communication is stored on your server within the meaning of the statute, it is a facility through which an electronic communication.
So by in your view, as soon as something that is an email is copied onto any server, that becomes a facility for electronic communications. By virtue of the fact that a copy was made of a document that was an email. That's your position.
Yes, it is my position, but those aren't the facts of this case. In this case, NetGate wasn't providing access to a different server, as alleged in.
It was my impression that it was. My understanding that it was a web server. It was not the mail server. It was a different computer, but maybe that I'm wrong about that.
As alleged in the complaint, the server to which NetGate allowed access was its own server. Whether it was the same mail server that was used for storing emails.
Well, it may be theirs, but not every server they have is a mail server. They can have servers for web server, they can have servers for file servers, all sorts of servers that have nothing to do with its business of providing being ISP. And I take it what you're saying is that every server owned by an ISP then becomes a server covered by the statute.
Yes.
Ooh. Okay.
Let me take you then to 2701C, which provides an exception for liability under 2701A, and I'll read it. I've read it as many times as I have, probably more, by a person or entity providing a wire or electronic communication service. And you had an authorization here, it seems, by NetGate. So why is that an exception to liability?
There was an authorization, Your Honor, by NetGate, but
right.
In this case, NetGate's unilateral decision to provide a sample of the contents of its users' electronic or private electronic communications doesn't fall within that exception.
Why not?
First of all, that exception provides 2701C provides two different exceptions.
Right.
That there's one and two.
User and provider.
User and provider. So as to subsection two, it's the user of the service that can authorize access to the contents of his or her electronic email.
They're connected by a nasty word, or.
Right. As to subsection one, that authorization, if understood in view of the policy underlying the statute, has to mean that it's lawful and otherwise valid authorization. It can't be the case that the authorization that is procured is invalid authorization, which is the case that happened here.
It wasn't invalid. They had a subpoena.
It was a subpoena that was held to be patently unlawful by magistrate in Brazil.
After the fact. At the time it provided, they had a court order, which a subpoena is. Court order said, provide access. How could that be unlawful? They complied with the court order.
Your Honor, under that reasoning, then, if it, a slightly different set of facts illustrates the point. If
you don't agree with that reasoning.
No, actually,
okay.
I wouldn't.
Okay.
If the appellees in this case had, rather than issued a subpoena that was later found to be unlawful, and instead had sat at their computer and created a subpoena that they knew to be unlawful, there's no pending litigation. The person just thinks, I need a creative way to get into the server. I don't know how to hack into a computer, so instead what I'm going to do is create a litigation that doesn't exist, create Northern District of California subpoena letterhead, create the mandate to NetGate to turn over the documents, serve that on NetGate.
That might well be a different case. If you have a totally fraudulent subpoena, you have no case at all. Maybe they had it, from the issued by the Western District of California, let's say, or it doesn't exist.
Not yet.
Or from the 12th Circuit.
Now you're talking.
That might well be a different case, and we certainly want to think about that when it comes along, but what we have here is a real case, and we have a real subpoena, that until quashed by a court is a valid court order. And I am having difficulty, it's a real court, it's a real case, it's a real subpoena. On its face, it is valid, and it is in fact valid, and has the force of law unless and until it is quashed by the court. So I, interesting hypothetical, but how do you deal with your actual case where you have an actual court order?
An actual court order that is invalid, and I appreciate the point that the invalidity and the unlawfulness was found after the subpoena was issued, but there should be no distinction under the statute.
Let me just quibble with you a little bit on the word invalid. There are two kinds of meanings invalid could have. Invalid could mean on its face, the kind of invalid you were talking about earlier, it's not even issued by a real court. There's no real case. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about invalidity in the sense that it is a valid court order. And you must comply with it. Court orders are like that. Until something else happens. So it's not invalid in the first sense. Until the court acts to undo it, the subpoena is valid in every sense of the word. It's no less valid than a district court order that may be subject to reversal and appeal. Is it?
What do you do with the fact that this information was furnished before the return date, and there was no proper notice to the other parties?
If I might answer Judge Kaczynski's question before I answer yours,
I think they're linked together.
I think they are linked together, so feel free to meander back and forth.
Judge Fletcher, the answer to your question is that the two facts that you point out, one, that the information was turned over before the return date, and two, that it was done before there was an opportunity for a motion to quash to have been brought, underscores the problem with using an invalid subpoena in this context. I mean, essentially what you have here is really a creative hacking by
the subpoena. Let's talk about those two facts, because I think they are important. The return date, what is the significance of the return date as far as you understand?
That's the date by which the documents sought under the subpoena have to be produced.
In other words, if you don't produce them by that date, or if you produce them at a later point in time, you are in contempt.
Yeah.
But nothing says you can't produce them. The subpoena is immediately effective. You have some time to comply, but if you don't want to wait, you could satisfy the subpoena by providing it early. There's no violation, right?
That's true generally, but
okay. How about the second factor that Judge Fletcher asked about? The chance, the right, or the opportunity for your clients to object. Does that bear the validity of the subpoena?
Absolutely, because to the extent that the subpoena is overbroad and later found to be patently unlawful, the attorneys who should have had an opportunity to object but didn't have an opportunity to object because the time frame was too short before they could put that motion on file were essentially stuck. NetGate took the subpoena, and in this respect, the facts of the case are very important. NetGate received the subpoena, not knowing what to do with it, called counsel for the appellees in this action and said, I have this subpoena, what am I supposed to do? The response was, produce the documents. NetGate explained
That's right.
NetGate went on to explain that the volume of documents that would be responsive to this overbroad subpoena was so voluminous that it was almost impracticable to do. So what it offered was to provide an early sample of the email, which it knew was going to contain the electronic private email communications of some 18 users, and it said, should I do this, essentially? And what counsel did without notifying appellant's counsel in the trial court was say, yes, do that. It might be
They were happy with it. Why should they not do that? Is there anything, did they have a duty to notify an adverse party?
Magistrate Brazil found that yes, counsel did have a duty, and that's why sanctions were awarded.
I'm sorry. That they had a duty to notify.
That part of the problem with the subpoena and part of what made it invalid was that counsel for the appellants in this case, in the trial court, didn't have an opportunity to make a motion to quash, didn't have an opportunity to stop the uploading of that sample of emails because notice was never given. Appellant's counsel had no idea that it was going to happen, while appellee's counsel did and did nothing to notify and thereby essentially tied the appellant's counsel's hands in the trial court and prevented that motion to quash, which otherwise might have been the remedy from ever having
And you're claiming res judicata on the issue of the propriety, or the validity of it?
Yes, essentially. I mean, that's not how
You're saying what the magistrate judge held, that they had a duty to notify the breach of duty in that res judicata. And you argue that renders the subpoena invalid because they didn't comply with one of them.
And invalidates the authorization for the purposes of the TCPA, which then negates the exception, and that's why it doesn't apply in this case.
Well, I'm reading your brief. Doesn't it boil down to your asking us to go through 2701C, the word in the OR is and?
No.
No, you keep saying you have to get permission to the user.
To the extent that the service provider can provide authorization, that authorization has to be valid authorization. I'm not saying that there are no situations in which a facility provider can provide that access.
So if this subpoena had been upheld by the court, the court took a look at the subpoena and said, perfectly good subpoena, then you would have got it.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
So the after... The fact invalidation of the subpoena is what creates your case.
The invalidity of the subpoena and the unlawfulness, the unlawful use of it as a key to get into an otherwise private server is what makes the case.
You've got 49 seconds. Would you like to save it?
I'll save that for the final. Thank you, Your Honor.
afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Robert White, and I'm a fellow counsel for Appley Alwyn Ferry Jones. The factual issue of what happened on the Netgate server, the court will find at Excerpt of Record 580, a portion of paragraph 39 of the complaint. Starting at line 1 of Excerpt of Record 580.
Excuse me, this is in...
Volume 1, I believe.
Volume 1.
I'm sorry, volume 2, Your Honor. Volume 2, Excerpt of Record 580.
Based on 580?
Yes.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
Surely.
And which paragraph are we looking at?
We're looking at line 1 at the top of the page, two words from the end. Netgate provided the confidential email information to Bosney and Ferry Jones electronically by uploading the data to the Netgate website and then delivering to Bosney the URL that was necessary to access and view the information. In other words, Your Honor is correct, that if Judge Kaczynski of the panel is correct, that the information was not accessed directly from the email accounts. It was copied, and it was placed
into Netgate's web server.
Under some file space on the server, but not part of their email function.
Okay, well, why then isn't the very copying, the accessing of the emails, which were originally found on the mail server, and done by Netgate, why aren't the actions of Netgate attributable to your client? Essentially, what they did is, it's as if they were a messenger. Netgate acted for your client and said, okay, we'll copy this stuff. And in order to copy it, they had to access the server.
And that would give the appellants a fine cause of action against Netgate under Section 2702 of the Act.
You know, it's like hiring somebody to kill somebody else. You can get both.
No,
you don't have to just get the trigger man. You get the guy who hires as well. So if in fact Netgate was acting on behalf of Ferry Jones, Ferry Jones, when it took the mail from its mail server and copied it into its web server, then it is an agent. Ferry Jones is the principal. And basically, Netgate's hands become Ferry Jones' hands.
I don't see it as an agency relationship at all, Your Honor, because first, Congress makes a distinction under 2701.
Well, didn't they do it as a result of a telephone conversation that they had where they said, we're going to comply with your subpoena. Here's our way in which we're going to comply with your subpoena. And counsel said, yeah, that's fine, that's great. You go ahead and do that. Go to your server, copy it, put it someplace where we can reach it. Why isn't it when they do that, when they do the copying, they access their own mail server, why aren't they acting on behalf of Ferry Jones?
They're no more acting on his behalf than what I asked this panel to affirm the judgment. You're acting on my behalf. That doesn't create an agency relationship, Your Honor. There was a subpoena issued, a subpoena that was regular on its face. Under the Stored Communications Act, it is up to either the party affected or the ISP in this case to grant access. And in one of the cases in our brief, Sherman versus Sultan, the District Court for the Eastern District of Michigan notes that the party that gains access, the party in Ferry Jones's position, is under no obligations under the Stored Communications Act with respect to what that person does with the information. The party that has obligations as to what's done with the information is the ISP under 2702. And one of the themes that frankly mystifies me throughout here is there's a good lawsuit here against Netgate. There's no lawsuit here against Ferry Jones.
Well, your client didn't give proper notice to the other side.
I agree, and I do not for one moment defend that. That was an unprofessional act, and it was wrong.
In bad faith?
That is what the magistrate judge found. I concede that, and I acknowledge it. But the short answer to it is if you look at the circumstances, it was Netgate's idea to offer the preview. Again, I don't defend the acceptance of that proposal. I don't defend the failure to notify opposing counsel. But the issue here is authorization under the Stored Communications Act.
Well, how could it be authorization as a denotative and a connotative meaning? How could this be authorization? It's more like acquiescence to a bad subpoena shoved down your throat.
No.
They were just trying to stay out of the way and comply. It was compliance. It wasn't authorization.
Compliance would have been, to take Your Honor's point, compliance would have been if Medicaid had simply produced the subpoenaed material at the return date and said, here it is. That's compliance.
What if, and I know this is not what happened, but what if counsel had called up the principal ISP and said, you know, we have some information, very unpleasant information about your activities at the Notel Motel, and if you would not like to have that put on the internet,